Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones, and there have been more Israeli airstrikes on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. It comes after Israeli forces also fired on UN peacekeepers in Lebanon, wounding two. The Lebanese health ministry says the strikes on Beirut have left 22 people at least dead and more than 100 injured. And an hour ago or so, I spoke to the BBC's Anna Foster. She's in Beirut, and told me more about what's happening there.
We saw and heard these very powerful strikes not far, actually, from the area that I'm speaking to you from. What is notable is that, again, this is a strike in the central area of Beirut, small Shia neighbourhood, very close to downtown, very close to the UN, but notably not the southern suburbs area where so many of these Israeli airstrikes have been so far. And that is why we're seeing and hearing already a very large death toll, because this is an area that is still busy. I was there earlier today, and the sound of an Israeli drone was very loud and low in the sky above. People were extremely nervous because they feared another strike. And just a few hours later, it has happened. But it's a busy area. There was no warning. And they're still digging through the rubble looking for survivors.
So what sort of building was it, you know?
Well, the indications are that these strikes were both on residential buildings. And looking at some of the pictures that are coming through on Lebanese TV, we're seeing one building that looks like it's collapsed and another building where two apartments seem to have been hit by a missile. So the ones above and below are still intact, but two actual apartments have been completely destroyed, windows out, walls gone. There is some indication, or certainly some reports in the local media, that this might have targeted the brother-in-law of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, who was killed nearly 2 weeks ago now. No confirmation of that just yet. If that was the case, then I expect that Israel would have something to say about it fairly soon. So at the moment, that is just, you know, local suggestion. But certainly they had a target in mind in this particular area. Away from where, you know, most of Hezbollah's top commanders have been based.
Yeah, and is the brother-in-law involved in Hezbollah? Is he a leader? Is he in a leadership position?
Yeah, the suggestion is that he is, again, one of their senior commanders in the area of intelligence and operations. Because we've been hearing, haven't we, as well, about, you know, some of these senior figures who are perhaps being lined up to be the new Secretary General, the new leader, to take over that role that Hassan Nasrallah has left vacant. And it seems very much like the Israeli strategy at the moment is trying to target those individuals who might potentially fill that gap.
But with quite a significant civilian death toll.
We've been watching the ambulances ferry people to at least five different local hospitals. And as I say, it's late here now, and we know that they're still going through the rubble in these two areas, so that death toll could potentially rise even higher.
And that was the BBC's Anna Foster speaking there from Beirut. We have contacted the Israeli Defence Forces. They said no one is available this evening to talk about this. We've got Nada Atala, though. She's a reporter for The National in Beirut, and quite close, I think, to where these strikes happened. Where are you?
Hi, sure. Yeah, so when the strike happened, so there was two strikes, and so we were like, I think 1 or 2 kilometers away from the strikes. They were pretty central, and so we were like in the center of Beirut. And so it felt like we felt massive booms, you know, the windows shook. And usually, so the strike, we're more used to hear them from the suburbs, so they feel more more distant. So we definitely felt that something unusual was happening, like something like much closer was, Israel was striking much closer than to us than usual. And, you know, Beirut also is a very small city, you know, so you always like, you know, a 5-minute drive away from a potential very deadly strike.
Sure, but I mean, most of the attacks have been in southern Beirut, and you can steer clear of that. But it, I guess it's much harder to steer clear of the centre, if and lots of people live in the centre.
Yeah, of course, yeah, there's very like densely populated area. So one of the strikes was actually a couple of meters away from my my friend's house. Like, it's a very, you know, just very normal people living there. So we went to check on her house, and everything was fine. Like, it was a couple of meters away, not on her house, is fine. But, you know, we had like lots of ambulances, some people even like leaving and packing. And of course, the atmosphere was very tense, and the army has, you know, closed off the area to let the rescue operation going on.
I mean, yeah, the Lebanese are, you're used to so much conflict, but this must make a lot of people in Beirut quite frightened now.
Yeah, exactly. So unfortunately, I guess we are normalizing a very high level of violence, which we should absolutely not. But this is, you know, piling up. And, you know, like today, because it is closer to areas which have not been evacuated, you know, and there was no warning. So, of course, people are getting extremely worried. I had like all my family reaching out to me, very scared, where I was, and yeah, if I was safe. You know, there was 22 people who were killed so far, and more than 100 wounded on a very densely populated area.
Now, the IDF haven't given a statement, but generally speaking, Israel makes the point that if there are people from Hezbollah or Hamas in Gaza who are living amongst civilians, then that is, you know, there's going to be collateral damage, as that horrible phrase has it. Is that how people in Beirut see it? Are they blaming Hezbollah, or are they blaming Israel?
So I guess also, you know, there's the international humanitarian law, and there's, you know, the principle of proportionality. So that's, you know, also something to take into consideration. I think people are firstly blaming Israel, you know, when regardless of the position on Hezbollah, the country is very divided on Hezbollah. And some would blame Hezbollah of, you know, dragging Lebanon into a war that it is not part of. But, you know, the one who's, you know, launching the bombs for the Lebanese, you know, it's Israel. So that's mainly how it is seen. You know, the main culprit to blame is for them definitely Israel.
Yeah, and it says once again that Hezbollah's thoroughly infiltrated, right? It seems that Israel knows where everyone is.
Yeah, sure. It comes after, you know, a huge blows inflicted to the first after, you know, the wave of the pager explosion, and, you know, most of also the senior commanders of Hezbollah who've been decimated. So it's, you know, another blow to the group, you know, who was once described as a formidable militia. So yeah.
Okay. Well, look, thanks very much for bringing us the information you can from the scene and that analysis. That's Nada Atala there, who is a reporter in Beirut for the national newspaper and happened to be pretty close to where those bombs went off, a kilometre or so away, when they went off. Now, there's a broader theme going on today as well, because a UN commission of inquiry based in Geneva has accused Israel of carrying out a deliberate policy of destroying Gaza's healthcare system. And it went further than that. The investigators said repeated Israeli attacks, and this was a press release from the inquiry, on medical facilities and the killing of torture of medical personnel amount to war crimes, and they use the word extermination. Well, Juliet Toomer is the communications director of UNRWA. So we've got the UNIFIL, the peacekeepers in Lebanon, saying two of their people have been wounded, got this UN commission of inquiry, and she's with UNRWA, who actually spoke to us yesterday in the programme about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. But UNRWA and Israel are also clashing, and I asked for her take on that relationship between Israel and UNRWA.
It's at rock bottom, unfortunately, especially with attempts to dismantle UNRWA through the different key variations. including most recently through bill that we understand is put forward to being approved at the Israeli parliament.
The media reports today about the UNRWA headquarters in Jerusalem being closed down. Have you heard anything about that?
We saw those reports. However, UNRWA was never officially informed by the Israeli authorities about these plans.
And your people are working in the UNRWA office normally, are they, in Jerusalem?
Oh, absolutely. We have our West Bank field office is in that building. We have the Jerusalem headquarters in that building, which also provides services to 40,000 children, as one example, who go to UNRWA schools across the occupied West Bank, including in East Jerusalem.
Now then, can you explain to us what is the legal basis for UNRWA being in the region in the first place? As you say, there's this proposal in the Knesset to stop UNRWA working in the occupied territories. Who gives you the mandate to do it? It's the UN, presumably, is it?
The United Nations General Assembly has given a mandate to establish UNRWA in 1949 to provide services, especially education and primary health care, to Palestine refugees in the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, Syria, Lebanon and Jordan.
But without Israeli cooperation, you couldn't really do that work, I guess.
It is a given that the United Nations operates in conflict zones in very close cooperation with parties to the conflict. And parties to the conflict are mandated to facilitate the work of the United Nations agency to deliver vital assistance to people in need.
So your plan is to stay as long as you can, I guess?
It is very difficult for us to know what are the consequences of all of this. And right now, our focus is to continue to deliver humanitarian assistance and basic services to people who need us most.
Are you able to comment on the statements coming out of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon today about two of their personnel being injured by Israeli tank fire?
It is very, very sad. Bear in mind, this is becoming way too commonplace. At UNRWA alone, in the past year, we have lost 226 of our team members in Gaza who were all killed during the war. We have 2/3 of UNRWA facilities have been hit in the past 1 year. This is an unprecedented attack on the United Nations, not only in Gaza, but also now in Lebanon.
Have you presumably communicated with the United States about your concerns you've just been expressing? What sense are you getting of the position of the U.S. administration on UNRWA and the UN more generally in the region?
We've been communicating about all these violations against the United Nations, against UNRWA, since they started, which is a year ago. The information is out there. It is time for action. And if there is a time to preserve multilateralism, including United Nations, the time is now. We are at a serious existential risk.
And that was Juliet Tuma. She is the communications director of UNRWA. I just got a chance now to tell you that if you ever miss an edition of the programme and want to keep up to date with what's going on around the world, then you can download the NewsHour podcast. It comes out twice a day, every day of the year, with obviously a very comprehensive wrap of what's happened in the world over the last 12 hours or so before the podcast gets published. So that's the NewsHour podcast, wherever you get your podcast, BBC NewsHour, twice a day, every day of the year. Coming up a little later in this programme, we'll hear from the Australian pop icon Kylie Minogue as she embarks on a new global tour.
It's so weird because I never stop working, but then there's these peaks, and I really look at it like, not that I'm a surfer, but I have caught a wave once in my life, so I understand the principle. A lot of paddling. We're paddling, paddling.
And some headlines. Lebanese officials say new Israeli airstrikes in Beirut have killed at least 22 people and injured more than 100. As operations against Hezbollah continue. A UN inquiry has accused Israel of deliberately destroying Gaza's health system. And the emergency services in Florida have rescued now more than 4,000 people since Hurricane Milton struck. Many West Europeans see NATO as a defensive alliance. Many in Russia think it's expansionist, forever pushing eastward. And those different perceptions were very much in mind at a meeting today in London between Ukraine's President Zelensky and the new Secretary-General of NATO, Mark Rutte. Now, Zelensky has been asking for permission to use long-range Western weapons to strike targets deep inside Russia. So when he spoke to the BBC, Mark Rutte was asked about that. He said the decision would be up to individual NATO members.
Ukraine is allowed legally to strike targets in Russia when these targets pose a threat to Ukraine. So legally, this is possible. It is not one weapon system which will change the outcome of this conflict. And then, of course, it is up to the individual allies to decide when they deliver weapon systems into Ukraine, how they can be used and what kind of commitments they give in terms of for Ukraine to use these systems. This is not up to the alliance as a whole. This is up to the individual ally members.
Well, in that case, is London likely to agree to the Ukrainian request for relaxation of the rules? Jonathan Beale, our defence correspondent.
There is a strong feeling within the UK Ministry of Defence that Ukraine should be allowed to use weapons like Storm Shadow, which the UK has provided to Ukraine, to hit targets inside Russia. But it's a political decision, and this government at the moment does not want to go it alone and is waiting to get a green light from the US essentially to do it. And I think for that reason is not in a position to say, I think they've given lots of positive noises to President Zelensky, but they have not yet said he can do it.
Because London fears there would be Russian reprisals against Britain.
I don't think it's necessarily that. I mean, of course, escalation is the reason given why Western countries are reluctant to allow Ukraine to use the long-range weapon supply. Let's remember that there are a limited number of countries in the West that have supplied long-range weapons, and we're mainly talking about France, the US and the UK. Germany has ruled it out, for example. It does have a weapon system that could be used, but the Taurus, they haven't given it to Ukraine, and they won't give it to Ukraine, they say. But I think it's less to do with about the escalation for the UK, because I think we've heard plenty of saber rattling from the Russians in the past about red lines, and then they've been crossed. So, you know, don't supply Western tanks. Western tanks were supplied. Don't supply F-16 jets. F-16 jets were supplied. So I think there are people who just wonder whether these are empty threats from the Russian. They may not be, but there are countries that clearly are worried about what Russia might do next, and therefore I think that's one of the reasons. The other argument given by the US is that they do not think they would make a huge difference. And let's remember, we are talking about a pretty small number of weapons, in the hundreds that have been given to Ukraine that could hit targets deep inside Russia. And Ukraine's been doing a lot more of that with its own drones that it's producing.
OK, what about the feelings in, let's say, Paris, London, Berlin about a Trump victory? Are they calculating what that could mean for Zelensky and for Ukraine?
They have to, and they would be incredibly unwise not to. It was certainly something that the head of NATO, Mark Rutte, was asked when he came onto the steps of Downing Street. His line in public is that don't worry about a Trump presidency. I think Donald Trump, and remember, he dealt with him when he was the Dutch Prime Minister. Some people call him the Trump Whisperer because he managed to have some sort of relationship with Donald Trump at a time when he was threatening to pull the rug under from NATO. He says that he believes Donald Trump understands the importance of NATO. Whatever he says publicly, that he realises that it is there for America's security as well as Europe's security. But I think there is a real concern about what happens to Ukraine, not just in Kyiv, but in European capitals. And that's why you've seen some effort to ramp up their own military production initiatives that have started off in Europe. And let's remember, F-16s, the countries that initially said they were going to supply them, they had to get the permission of the US because it's an American-made jet. But they were European countries. So there are European countries who've been doing things on their own initiative. But when you look at the amount of kit that's given to Ukraine, the lion's share comes from the US, and the Ukraine would not be able to win, even to defend itself. It would probably be defeated by Russia without that American military support.
And that was Jonathan Beal. This year's Nobel Prize for Literature has been won by the South Korean writer Han Kang. Her book, The Vegetarian, first brought her to attention to a mass audience in the West. It's an intense and darkly erotic novel, an international bestseller, and the winner of the International Man Booker Prize in 2016, upon which she spoke to NewsHour.
Whenever I write novels, I feel I have to deal with my fundamental theme, which is what means being human. So because of that difficult question, this novel has become so dark and fierce, and I had to handle these difficulties Younghae, the protagonist, had to go through.
Well, Anton Herr has translated some of Han Kang's work and spoke to James Menendez about his reaction to her Nobel success.
Oh, I haven't stopped crying in the past hour.
Really?
Yes, it is. It is incredible news, because it is news that we've, as a nation, have been waiting for years and years and years. And to have it happen to Han Kang is just perfect. It's the cherry on the cake.
What makes her so special as a writer, in your opinion?
The fact that she is a woman writer. I know it's not fashionable to say so, but it is a very important point in a country where there is so much misogyny and discrimination against women, that a woman writer who was not necessarily the front runner for prizes and for funding in her home country suddenly becomes the Booker Prize winner in 2016, and then now is the Nobel Prize winner. The fact that she wrote about two key traumatic events in Korean history. First, it was the Gwangju democracy movement of 1980. And then there was, she has more recently written about the April 3rd massacre of in Jeju Island, which some people say is the precursor to the Korean War. And it's just so wonderful that, A, that Korea has produced a Nobel Prize winner in literature, and B, that it is this particular author and not some other author who is more problematic, and we won't get into that.
Right, okay. The role of women and the position of women in South Korea, I mean, is it right to say that that is a sort of key theme in the Vegetarian?
Very much so. But Han Kang, while she definitely does write about women and from a woman's perspective, obviously, she also writes about the disenfranchised across society. And as she just said in her comment that you played just now, her preoccupation is what makes us human, what is humanity, and how do we lose our humanity and how do we regain it? Is there redemption? And yeah, her topic is universal, it's humanist, and I think that's what makes her the perfect international author and really the perfect Korean author to win the Nobel Prize.
But not for the faint-hearted. I mean, these aren't easy novels, are they?
They are not. So when this prize was, when the Nobel Prize was being announced, I was actually in a meeting for the International Booker Prize 2025, because I'm in the jury. And Max Porter, who is the publisher of The Vegetarian in the UK, he's also in the jury. And so we were both, like, as you can imagine, our reaction was very, like, it interrupted the meeting, let's say that.
I can imagine it did. That was the South Korean novelist and translator Anton Herr there. You're listening to The World Service of the BBC.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
You're listening to NewsHour. Now, over 100 million people are living with near to full blindness in sub-Saharan Africa, and in Uganda, it's more than 3 million people affected. And while many benefit from access to medical facilities there, there are people living in rural areas who really struggle to get adequate treatment. And the BBC's Agnes Pender has been to a community of blind and visually impaired people on the shores of Lake Victoria. It's in eastern Uganda, and they've decided to come together to help each other.
Seated on the patio outside their home, 53-year-old Moses Mugave is teaching his children how to read in Braille.
I pray to God, thank him for the gift of life he has given me.
After becoming blind, Moses decided to set up the Lubu Group of the Blind, a community of about 25 people affected by blindness or other forms of sight loss. They live together in a compound of 10 houses in the town of Lubu along the shores of Lake Victoria.
Losing my sight upset me. I struggled with my mental health because I thought it was the end for me. I worried about losing friends, about all the things I could no longer do.
The group of the blind gathers weekly to discuss the issues that matter most to them.
We formed the Lubu Blind Group after realizing that the town was isolating us. We face a lot of challenges, from thieves who target us because of our disability to unfair treatment when it comes to dividing family assets. And for some of us, finding a marriage partner is difficult. We talk about how we can support ourselves and keep our children in school, how we can feed and clothe them.
In sub-Saharan Africa, more than 100 million people suffer from near to complete blindness, according to data from the International Agency for the Prevention of Blindness. Vision loss could be prevented in at least 90% of cases, but for that to happen, treatment needs to become readily available.
We are training doctors. The government is encouraging many doctors to go for masters in ophthalmology so they can become a specialist in eye care.
Dr. Alfred Mubangizi is a tropical disease expert at Uganda's Ministry of Health. He says the government is incentivizing trainee doctors to specialize in eye care.
As I talk now, there's still a scholarship. The government puts actually money there. People to go and study for free. Government pays for you to go and do masters or specialize in eye care.
Uganda is facing a shortage of eye doctors. Back in Lubu, Moses is optimistic that the younger generation stands a better chance.
The only hope and prayer I have for my children, I want them to complete their education. I need them to graduate with degrees. When they're educated enough, nobody will notice that they are blind. People will look at their achievements and they'll be a source of inspiration for others.
And that was Moses Mugabe speaking there to the BBC's Agnes Pender. In the US state of Florida, people woke today to mass destruction. Cranes having smashed into buildings, trees blown down, major flooding. And Hurricane Milton made landfall in Florida overnight with winds reaching almost 200 kilometres per hour. At least 11 people are confirmed dead and more than 3 million homes and businesses without power now. But the hurricane has now moved offshore. It's over the Atlantic Ocean. In an address from the White House, Joe Biden urged residents to remain cautious.
It's too early to know the full account of the damage, though. But we know life-saving measures did make a difference. There are still very dangerous conditions in the state, and people should wait to be given an all clear by their leaders before they go out. We know from previous hurricanes that it's often the case that more lives are lost today following the storm than actually during the storm itself. Vice President Harris and I have been in constant contact with the state and local officials. We're offering everything they need.
And that was President Biden. Now we're going to the west coast of Florida now, just north of Tampa, Cedar Key. It's an island off the coast there, home to about 700 people. And it got hit badly by Hurricane Helene a couple of weeks ago. Not too bad this time by comparison. James Menendez spoke to Mike Bobbitt, who lives on Cedar Key Island. Does he feel he dodged a bullet?
Absolutely, in every sense of the word. It was a long, stressful night of waiting for a sword to drop that never did. As you mentioned, we were absolutely devastated during Hurricane Helene with nearly 12 feet of storm surge. Most of our commercial buildings are in ruin, more than half of our homes. And we had a solid 9 days of cleanup where we had debris piled multiple stories high all over the island. And the fear was that the hurricane force winds would create projectile missiles all over town and undo all of our work. But we, throughout the night, it just never came, and no storm surge at all. In fact, we had negative storm surge because we were north of the storm. We got the clean side of the hurricane. 3 miles of water in the Wakasasa Bay washed out. You could walk 3 miles into the bay before you found any water. We are feeling just enormously blessed this morning.
It is just relative, though, as you say, that the cleanup from Helene can now continue, I guess.
Sure, but we have literally months ahead of us. I've never been so pleased to see giant piles of debris all over my town because they're right where we left them. And already we're out. We've got our trucks out and our boots and our work gloves, and the whole town is out working to just push the work forward. I think there could not have been a better outcome from what we were facing 24 hours ago.
I mean, are some people wondering whether it's just becoming too dangerous as these storms become more powerful?
I think so. I think maybe some of the northerners that moved to Florida who thought they knew what they were getting into have maybe decided that this isn't for them. But not me. I'll live on this island for the rest of my life if I have to live in a tent under the bridge. The natural splendor of this area, being able to have a working waterfront where blue-collar people can make a living from the Gulf of Mexico. We're primarily clam farmers and oystermen and commercial fishermen here. We really are a village lost in time, and I think it's a place worth protecting. And I've always described the Gulf as the great provider. It provides our jobs, our income. But sometimes it's an angry God and it comes to exact a price. And we've paid that price now. This was our fourth major hurricane in 13 and a half months. But prior to that, we had been multiple decades without any significant damage from a hurricane. So if you smooth those statistics out, it's not so bad.
A philosophical islander there, Mike Bobbitt on Cedar Key. Off Florida. Well, our correspondent Rowan Bridge has been just trying to keep on top of what's happening around the states, Florida and elsewhere, from Washington, D.C., and told me the latest.
The situation remains serious. I mean, this was one of the most powerful storms to hit Florida in a century. Now, it didn't hit with quite the impact that the worst predictions had. It lost some of its energy before it came ashore, but even so, if you look at some of the pictures, some of the damage that it's caused is pretty devastating. And there have been at least 6 deaths as a result of Hurricane Milton. 3 million homes and businesses remain without power. There are warnings from the governor, Ron DeSantis of Florida, of flooding to be expected in coming days. If you look at the St. Petersburg area on the West Coast, the water supply there has been cut off and people have been advised to boil their water. Perhaps some of the most dramatic pictures came from the Tampa Bay Rays baseball stadium, which was actually being used as a shelter for first responders. But the roof of that baseball stadium got ripped off by the power of the winds that went over it. But fortunately, there were no injuries there.
Right. Now, then, there's a question about funding, I think. I was quite struck. Biden there said, you know, the money's all going, it's fine. But there is an issue, isn't there, about whether Congress will allow funds to flow, presumably because of the election coming up.
Yeah, I mean, the question was around FEMA and the SBA. So FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The SBA is the Small Business Administration. And in this context, what we're talking about is federal organizations that are involved in the response to disaster in terms of offering support to people and businesses in the Florida area and the other places affected by hurricanes. Now, the issue has been around, do they have the funding they need going forward to do the work that they need to be able to do? The reporting suggests that FEMA probably has enough money until Congress returns in November. But the concern is that the Small Business Administration could run out of funding for loans to small businesses. And what you heard from President Biden earlier on in his news conference was him urging Congress to come back to provide further funding. But at the moment, they're not scheduled to return until after the presidential election on November the 5th. And the concern is, will the SBA run out of money for its loans before then?
Yeah, just looking at what Biden said, and the quote is, I think in terms of the SBA, it's pretty right on the edge at the moment. So, yes, he's confirming, you know, just exactly what you're saying. And he says, I think Congress should be coming back and moving on emergency needs immediately. I mean, I guess it's inevitable. This is becoming politicized, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has very much become politicized, not just about whether Congress will come back and provide extra funding, which has become obviously an issue between Congress and the president, but also around claims about how disaster relief has been handled and misinformation and disinformation that has circulated online that is fed into the political bloodstream as well, that has been picked up by the likes of Donald Trump and has been used as a political wedge in what is a very close and tight presidential election with people going to the polls in a matter of weeks' time. So claims around, you know, only $750 being available to people affected or money being diverted from migrants from disaster relief, both of which are untrue, both of which we've been seen repeated by Donald Trump and members of the Trump family. And what you've seen around this and Helene is a kind of politicization of disaster relief in a way that we really haven't seen before.
Yeah. Anyway, the storm is past, right? It's over the Atlantic. It's been and done its damage.
Yeah, I mean, it has. But obviously what you've got, and President Biden sort of referred to it in that clip that you played, is the problems of things like, for example, power lines will be down, you know, water is going to be lying around the area. And that poses a sort of secondary threat, if you like, to people. And that's why they were warning people not to return until the authorities tell them it's safe to.
And that was the BBC's Rowan Bridge in Washington, D.C. Now to a story which I should warn you is distressing. It's the court case which has gripped France for weeks now and left many appalled that a husband could drug his wife and procure her rape by dozens of other men. The decision of Gisèle Pelicot to waive her right to anonymity has evoked enormous respect, but by that act she's confronted both the men accused and France more generally. Not an unknown victim, in inverted commas, but a wife, a mother, a grandmother, a human like any other, as are the men on trial, though many continue to insist they do not believe what they did was rape. But in court they are being confronted with explicit video footage recorded at the time by Giselle's now former husband, Dominique. Andrew Harding has been speaking to one of the accused in Avignon.
She's getting used to the daily applause now. Gisèle Pelicot arriving in court as usual, cheered by members of the public. The rape victim who refuses to be shamed, a symbol in France and beyond of defiance. But today, the focus is not on her or her ex-husband, who's admitted to drugging and raping her for years. Instead, this extraordinary trial is now focusing on the 50 other men. Some out on bail, faces hidden under masks and hoods. Men who were accused of raping Pelicot as she lay unconscious in her own bed. In court, each man in turn has been confronted with footage of what they did, including video showing Pelicot snoring as she's assaulted. We've just been shown yet more videos filmed by Dominique Pelicot over the years inside the couple's bedroom.
They are shocking. I'm not going to go into details of what we saw. But clearly the prosecution believes that this is overwhelming evidence that those men who came into that bedroom must have known that Gisèle Pellicot was unconscious, that she could not have consented to what happened to her. But most of these accused men insist they are not rapists, that they genuinely believed that they were taking part in some sort of consensual sex game with the couple. Paul Roger Gontard is a lawyer defending one of the accused.
Gisèle Pellicot is a victim. We are sure about that. A victim of her husband, a victim of other guys. But we are not sure she's a victim of all the guys.
Some of those on trial say they were tricked by Dominic Pellicot, intimidated by him. At his house on the edge of Avignon, we spoke to one such man and agreed to keep his identity hidden since the trial is still ongoing.
Et là, je me suis dit, il n'est pas normal, cet homme. C'est un psychopathe.
I said to myself, he's not normal. This man is a psychopath. I was terrified, naked, caught in a trap.
Is there not within you any shred of feeling of responsibility for what you did?
Ça m'a transformé, cette affaire.
But the man offered no real answer, insisting he was simply a victim.
Jamais.
Which helps explain the frustration of so many still queuing to watch this trial every day, inspired by Gisèle Pellicot's courage, but worried too that some of the accused may be hunting for excuses for the inexcusable.
And with that report from Avignon, that was Andrew Harding. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. If the conservation charity, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, is to be believed, then wildlife populations are plummeting, really plummeting, down by an average of 73% in the past 50 years. Now, this report is based on the Living Planet Index of more than 5,000 bird, mammal, amphibian, reptile and fish population counts, which have been done over five decades. Dadi Sumba is the Chief Conservation Officer at the WWF. I asked him for more details on how they reached this figure.
This number is really a calculation of the average size of monitored populations over the 50 years. We are monitoring 5,000 species, over 35,000 populations. And the direction of travel for this report shows that it agrees with many other statistics from across the world that show steep declines of biodiversity, basically caused by human activity. And so there's collaboration of this number in other documents also elsewhere.
Well, you say that, but there is an article published by Springer Nature, but just back in June, saying the methodology you're using suffers from mathematical and statistical issues leading to a bias. And there are other suggestions that by putting such emphasis on Africa and Latin America, you're getting a not very representative global sample of wildlife. How do you respond to those points?
Okay, so we are aware of the critique, the mathematical critique, but overall the conclusion that the mathematical critique made basically substantially agrees with the decline. It only states that we overstate the decline by some factor because of the methodology around how we use zero, how we deal with absent populations. But in terms of, say, Europe and the other parts that you have mentioned, the idea is the starting point for this report is 1970. But Europe's populations and American populations were beginning to decline after the Industrial Revolution, where they had completely been lost. So they have been on an upward trajectory, as opposed to Africa, Latin America, Caribbean, and Asia, where, so to speak, the lack of industrial revolution hasn't affected the populations as such. And what we are seeing now is industrialization coming up and populations being lost very systematically in many parts. So the critique has been taken on and we have adjusted our methodology to speak to it. But the bottom line is that that critique, basically, when they finally concluded, they said that they agree with the narrative that numbers are declining, only that ours looked a bit higher than normal.
Right, so it's not quite as an authoritative report as we might hope for from the WWF. Nonetheless, tell us about the substance of the issue. Why do you say that this decline in wildlife is such a problem for the human population?
The decline in wildlife is a problem for the human population because wildlife and ecosystems provide ecosystem services on which nature and life depends. And if these are being degraded, people are going to lose those services that sustain life. For example, ecosystem regulation, water, they are going to lose air cleansing, climate regulation. These are important life support systems that ecosystems provide. If these are not there, then certain economic activities will not be possible.
And that was Daudi Sumba. He is the Chief Conservation Officer of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, talking about that pretty amazing claim that 73% of wildlife has gone in the last 50 years. Now, when Kylie Minogue first broke away from the Australian TV soap Neighbours so that she could launch a solo pop career, I think it's fair to say that many thought it wouldn't really work. I think it's fair to say that she wasn't sure it would really work. But maybe that just proves, once again, how hard it is to predict these things. After all, just think of all those publishers in London and elsewhere who turned down that not very promising book, Harry Potter. Well, Kylie went on to sell more than 80 million records, and she is now about to embark on her 15th world tour. The BBC's music correspondent, Mark Savage, marked that event by going to meet her.
Last year, the viral smash Padam Padam put Kylie Minogue back at the top of the charts. It's the latest chapter in a career that's been full of ups and downs. But the star says she never takes success for granted.
It's so weird because I never stop working, but then there's these peaks. And I really look at it like, not that I'm a surfer, but I have caught a wave once in my life. So I understand the principle. A lot of paddling.
Everybody needs
you're disturbing the whole street with a carry-on.
I don't hear anyone else complaining, you old bag.
The world might have discovered Kylie through the Australian soap opera Neighbours, but her musical ambitions predated her acting career.
You and your brother and sister used to perform Grease Lightning in the front room.
We would do that. Grease Lightning, girl, Grease Lightning. The same front room where the record player was, and I would play the Beatles, the Stones.
Her first hit single in the UK was I Should Be So Lucky. It was written in just 40 minutes, and many people predicted her singing career would last just as long.
People were pretty mean. What was the point where you felt, I'm actually confident in what I'm doing now?
I don't know what is in me that just made me keep going and work through that. It wasn't cool people were as nasty as they were. And that's not some kind of invisible person behind a keyboard. These were grown adults who kind of should have known better.
4 decades and more than 80 hit singles later, Kylie has proved the critics wrong. Next year, she sets off on her 15th world tour.
Lights, camera, action, that's it.
But she says it's not all glitz and glamour.
The fast changes that you do on stage, because you have 7 or 8 outfits per show, and sometimes you're in and out of them in under a minute. How does that happen practically?
I'm going to confess, a lot goes on in the quick change. I might swear a lot. It's frantic. It just takes one thing to go wrong and you're all freaking in the quick change. And I did pass by a wardrobe on a gig I did recently and I just said, I'm a despicable human being. I'm so sorry. And they're like, what happens in quick change stays in quick change. There's so much that's happened in my life that 8-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old, 20-year-old me would have not been able to even compute. You're going to meet Prince one day. You're going to go to Paisley Park. He's going to write a song for you. You're going to sing on stage with Madonna. I mean,
I'm jealous.
I'm amazed. I'm like, is this even my life?
Living the high life. Kylie Minogue there after so many years of success, and she draws us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. So thanks very much for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
I'm Krassi Twick from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, 10 years after the start of the war in Yemen, where do the warring parties stand? This battle between rival camps in the Middle East has reached a stalemate. Is there a way out? The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda and the disinformation. Find us wherever you get your BBC World Service podcasts.